Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program, AFSCME Correction Officers on Frontlines to Contain COVID-19. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question and answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded, and I'll be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to AFSCME President Lee Saunders. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. And good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us. I'm Lee Saunders, President of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, a union of 1.4 million public service workers across the country. I hope everyone is being strong and safe during this unsettling time. I'm joined today by my good friend, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. Also on the line are AFSCME Correction Officers Steve Wales from Connecticut, Michael Ryder from Ohio, and Brian Miller, also from Ohio. Three everyday heroes serving on the front lines. They will speak from firsthand experience about the challenges of keeping their communities safe inside our prisons, which are some of the worst COVID hotspots. Theirs is difficult work under the best of circumstances, but never more so than during a global pandemic. And the situation at Marion Correctional Institution in Marion, Ohio, where Brian works, is frightening and it's overwhelming, with roughly half the staff and 90% of inmates sick with coronavirus. I'm going to cut right to the chase. To keep brave public service workers on the job right now when they are needed most, Congress must pass as much state and local government aid as it takes to fix the problem. I wish I could give you an exact dollar figure, but things are changing quickly, and we want to make sure we have whatever we need to serve our communities. You know, close to 28 million people have filed for unemployment insurance in the last 6 weeks. The economy is in free fall, and the tax base is crumbling. As a result, state and local governments are going broke and beginning to impose layoffs and furloughs. But we cannot defeat COVID-19 and reopen our economy if frontline workers are thanked with pink slips. Let's be clear. Let's be clear what we mean when we talk about investing in state and local aid. It's not an abstraction. It means keeping nurses and other frontline healthcare workers on the job in a moment when thousands are getting sick every day. It means keeping corrections officers safely on the job with the tools needed to protect themselves and our communities. It means supporting frontline child care and home care providers who are teaching our children and caring for our most vulnerable people, often without personal protective equipment. It means social workers can help victims of domestic abuse who are trapped inside their homes with a violent partner. It means empowering behavioral health professionals who are helping people cope with the anxiety and mental health impact of this crisis. It means the schools are strong and the trash gets picked up. It means the streets and roads get fixed. It means clean water comes out of the tap. It means when you call 911, the ambulance shows up on time. That's what state and local aid means. There's nothing partisan or ideological about this. 21 Republican governors wrote a letter last month to congressional leaders asking for direct assistance to states to ease their burden and allow them to continue providing critical essential services. A bipartisan coalition of Ohio mayors made a similar plea to Congress just 2 weeks ago. The Senate Majority Leader, on the other hand, has callously and recklessly suggested that states and localities should just go bankrupt. Many indicated he might soften that stance, but only if businesses get protection against coronavirus-related lawsuits. You know, it's interesting how some folks can always find billions to bail out big corporations or to give the super wealthy generous tax breaks. But when working people in their communities need help, when it comes to funding essential public services in a life and death situation, they become stern deficit hawks. While public service workers stand fearlessly on the front lines of this pandemic, the Senate Majority Leader once again stands with wealthy corporate interests. At this moment of distress and despair for the nation, Public service workers are answering the call. Workers like Steve and Brian are showing courage and resilience under the most difficult and dangerous conditions. In doing so, at great personal risk to themselves and their families, putting the safety of their neighbors over their own well-being. Public service workers deserve the nation's respect and gratitude, not with words, but with action. For our service and sacrifice, we just have one simple request. Help from the federal government to do our job, jobs that have never been more important. The state and local aid received in the first few relief packages from Congress amounted to little more than a drop in the bucket. We need a bold and ambitious response proportionate to the magnitude of this crisis. This is an unprecedented moment, the gravest public health emergency in a century, which has triggered an economic nosedive and massive disruption to American life. We're doing our jobs. Congress should do theirs. It is time to fund the front lines. Now I want to turn the floor over to a good friend, someone who always has our back and stands in our corner, someone who sticks his neck out to fight for working people every single day, United States Senator from my native Ohio, Senator Sherrod Brown stands with working people. Sherrod?
Lee, thank you so much. President Lee Saunders, one of the great labor union activists in this country. He grew up in the city I'm in right now, in the city of Cleveland. So, Lee, thank you for being a champion for workers. And thanks for hosting the call. Thanks to Officers Miller, Ryder, and Wales for their service joining today. I'm especially honored to be joined by two Ohioans, Officer Miller and Officer Ryder. They serve our state well, and we will hear from them in a moment. Every day, many of us have the privilege to work from home, but workers like and get paid, but workers like the three officers joining today put their health and safety on the line to do their jobs. As Officer Miller unfortunately knows all too well, workers and incarcerated individuals at correctional facilities across the country are experiencing a disproportionately high number of COVID-19 cases. You know, I hear a lot of my colleagues, conservatives, liberal, kind of all, so many of my colleagues love to thank our frontline workers, but thank you isn't enough. We must do more to protect these officers who put themselves at risk. We need to invest in state and local governments. We need to pay these workers, these officers, these heroes. We need to pay them pandemic premium pay. We need to ensure our frontline workers have the safety protections they need to stay healthy. Local governments shouldn't have to choose between raising taxes or laying off corrections officers or police officers or firefighters or sanitation workers. COVID-19 hits our cities and counties and states particularly hard. They need robust, flexible funding to keep serving their residents. I was on a call yesterday with a Republican and a Democratic mayor from Ohio. You couldn't tell the difference in their request for federal actions. But last week, Mitch McConnell said it's okay to let cities go bankrupt. That's outrageous. That's outrageous. And what he said, how he said it, and his attitude. He seems to think this is only a problem in cities, in states led by Democrats, but this virus knows no political party. Communities all over our country are hurting, large and small, urban, suburban, rural, Democratic mayors, Republican mayors, Democratic commissioners, Republican commissioners. The officers on the call today or go to work and serve their communities despite the risks involved. They shouldn't have to risk their jobs as well to foot the bill for the global pandemic. We should be making sure they have the pay and the benefits they deserve. If we're going to tell these workers, you're essential to our country, you've got to go to work during a public health emergency, then their paychecks should reflect that. That's why I've led Senate Democrats to roll out a plan for what we call pandemic premium pay, a bonus of up to $25,000 for all the patriots putting their own health at risk to go to work for us, for our country right now. This pandemic premium pay must be part of anything Congress passes next. We must work to minimize the health risks of these officers showing up to work. We must have mandatory safety protections for all workers, and I mean all workers, whether you punch a clock or swipe a badge, whether you earn a salary or work for tips. Everyone on the job must be protected by a national enforceable standard. That should come from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. I'll be pushing to make sure it's in any bill Congress passes. If we don't protect workers, the virus will spread, more people will die, we'll have to shut down the economy again, and no one should ever fear for their life on the job. That's what the union movement's all about. That's why ASME is so important. Corrections officers deserve more than just our gratitude. They deserve real action from Congress that will make their jobs safer, that will protect their jobs, that will help keep them healthy and safe. That's what I'm fighting for. I'll stop there and turn things over to Officer Miller, whom I just met on the call a few minutes ago, works in Marion, and the stories he has to tell in one of the single worst epicenters in the country in Marion, Ohio. It's a community just north of Columbus, and I so appreciate the work that Officer Miller does for our state. Officer Miller, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Good afternoon. I'm Brian Miller. I have worked as a corrections officer at Marion Correctional Institution for 20 years. I'm also the chapter president of Local 11, 5110, OCSEA, and AFSCME. I'm currently fighting off the COVID-19 infection, so I might get a little winded at times, so I apologize ahead of time. Around mid to late March, we were notified that a staff member tested positive for coronavirus. Since then, more than 120 staff have fallen ill. Short staffing has left us without aid to clean and without enough hands on deck to keep control of the facility. Already overworked corrections officers have taken on even more responsibilities, including cleaning, prepping rooms, sanitizing, and assisting nurses as we send more than 10 inmates a day to the hospital when they become too ill for our facility to handle. I believe our facility was too slow to respond. Instead of shutting everything down, restricting movement, limiting staff contact, prevent an outbreak, there was a gradual tightening of the process. I even saw offenders that were concerned there wasn't more limited when we were not on lockdown. Now more than 90% of our inmates are positive. Half our staff is sick. One of our brothers has passed. One of our brothers has passed from the disease, and the National Guard has been brought in temporarily to help secure the facility. We are so short-staffed that we are pulling four or more doubles in a row. Those of us who are sick are forced to report to work after only 3 days of being symptoms-free without additional testing. There's no way to know whether we are exposing both staff and offenders. Things are beyond a breaking point at the facility. Leadership didn't include the union or input from people on the ground in the process at all. And now they don't know if we'll be able to get back to full staffing again. Being a corrections officer is a dangerous job on a good day. And right now it's hell. Our contract promises us $8 an hour hazard pay, which the state refuses to provide because of budget crisis. We are now getting $1.85 an hour. We put our lives on the line and walk into the chaos every day and get $1.85 an hour because Ohio is running out of money. This is less than Starbucks, Speedway, and Amazon are supplementing their employees. That was a promise that they can't keep. We need PPE. We need more funding. The National Guard is a stoppage, a stopgap. We're lucky to have them. But they have 2 days training and aren't a long-term solution. If there are layoffs, it will be absolute chaos. If Congress doesn't deliver additional funding and PPE to us, they're betraying us. They might as well cut our throats because layoffs and PPE shortages are a death sentence to corrections officers and the inmates. When I kick this disease, I will be back on the front line. I hope Congress will fund us and have our backs when I do. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michael Ryder. I work as a correction officer at Franklin Medical Center and the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio. I'm also a proud AFSCME member and president of OCSEA Chapter 2578. Franklin Medical Center serves as the main medical hub for offenders in need of health care. We see it all from victims of violent assault to people battling cancer and undergoing chemo. This virus, though, has totally overwhelmed our system. At OSU, we have a secure prison unit within the hospital, but some offenders are also spread out in satellite rooms outside of this area. Each satellite room is required to have an officer at each room. Typically, we would have upwards of 15 to 25 satellite rooms in the hospital, but this crisis has hit Ohio Corrections so hard that last week we had 106 patients in satellite rooms outside of the prison unit. The manpower required to cover all the offender spread throughout the hospital is the total amount of staff we have on a single shift at both Franklin Medical Center and OSU. That's our total operation. To deal with this crisis, correction officers have been mandated to work 16-hour shifts 4 and 5 days in a row. The National Guard has been activating and is helping us stand guard. Even parole officers are coming in to help handle this unprecedented demand. We have also had to change protocol. Instead of having an officer at each room, we'll have upwards of 10 to 12 rooms together and one correction officer and roughly two National Guardsmen standing by. So what we've done is we've combined rooms. While the severe understaffing is upsetting and presents an extra threat to safety, what we are most concerned about is the continued lack of personal protective equipment. When this first started, we weren't even given any masks. Even after the governor had declared a state of emergency, we had to fight to even be allowed to bring in our own PPE from home. Since then, we have been given surgical masks. But surgical masks only help prevent you from spreading the virus. They don't protect you from contracting it in the way an N95 mask does. They make us go through all these security measures, taking our temperature and asking us screening questions, and then they hand us a mask that does not protect us as we walk into a war zone. We need the federal government to stand up and do better by workers on the front lines. We need the federal government to provide for state and local funding so we can stay focused on maintaining safety and security for offenders and medical staff in our hospitals. We can't afford to lose anyone else. This virus seems to hit home harder than others, but we know we have to take this seriously. Many coworkers of ours have gotten sick. One of our colleagues has been in the hospital for 3+ weeks fighting for his life on a ventilator. He had recently moved in with an elderly mother to help her out, and now she's also sick in the hospital as well. I just learned that as of yesterday, we have another member as well that's fighting for his life on the ventilator as well. We are standing alongside medical professionals in the fight for our lives. We simply want to be treated with that same dignity and respect. Thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Wales, and I'm a correction officer at the Corrigan-Rogowski Correctional Center in Uncasville, Connecticut. I'm also a proud AFSCME member and the corresponding secretary for AFSCME Local 1565, Council 4, which represents correctional staff throughout Connecticut. In Connecticut, 326 correction officers and 417 inmates have tested positive for COVID-19, and these numbers continue to rise. Our maximum security facility houses roughly 1,000 inmates, from murderers serving multiple life sentences for their crimes to those awaiting trial for DUI. Like many jails and prisons across the nation, ours has become a petri dish for the virus to spread. Those who are symptomatic or have tested positive for COVID-19 are housed in a separate unit, and they are not allowed out of their cells. Those who are not sick are housed in the general population units and are allowed out of their cells for 30 minutes per day to shower and to make a phone call. But once their time is up, often they do not want to return to their cells, and they are becoming violent when we enforce this rule. This year marks my 20-year career as a correction officer. My job is dangerous every day, but COVID-19 has elevated the threat. As fear and anxiety take over, tensions are running high, and we are facing a horrifying scene inside of our facility. The inmates have heightened disregard for authority. They are attempting to escape the prison, and they are even staging attacks on officers. On Friday, three inmates attacked three correction officers. Following the attack, they admitted that they were trying to escape. And we have reason to believe they may have been trying to help others escape as well. My fellow officers and I understand the inmates feel trapped, and right now they are terrified. We've turned into counselors. We're trying to reassure them that these increased precautions are for their safety as well as ours. After all, I don't want them getting sick. I have a wife and kids at home, and it's my job to make sure they remain safe and healthy. My coworkers share in these fears. We are worried about our families. My family understands how difficult my profession can be. Over the years, I've had a couple of back surgeries, shoulder surgeries, a broken hand. But these injuries didn't affect my family. Coronavirus is a different story. My fellow officers and I know that we are putting our loved ones at risk. That weighs on us. Some officers have even self-quarantined and are living in hotels right now, some in campers in their own yards. Fortunately, the state eventually agreed to cover the expense of the hotels, while these officers are still missing out on valuable time with their families. At our facility, we are still short on PPE. The state finally distributed N95 masks last week, but COVID-19 hit us 6 weeks ago. Before the N95 masks arrived, the inmates in our industries program made canvas masks. The first allotment was distributed to the inmates, and the staff received the leftovers. Because so many officers are out sick with COVID-19, we are dangerously understaffed. With mandatory overtime in play, I have worked 40 straight days, and most of those have been 16-hour days, and I'm not the only one. There are a lot of us here in Connecticut who are outraged that we have legislators in our state who are minimizing the sacrifice public service workers make. They are pressuring the governor to hold off on an upcoming scheduled 3.5% pay raise for state employees, those who are on the front line of this crisis. We are putting our lives on the line every day. We do this because it is our duty to protect our communities. We do this because we care. So it is disgusting. It is disgraceful. And it is disrespectful to public service workers when we do not have adequate PPE or when we do not have adequate funding to support our work. The COVID-19 pandemic shows why it's crucial to adequately fund our state government programs, and that's why we're calling on Congress to provide robust funding for state and local governments in CARES too. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank Brian and Michael and Steve for telling their stories and what they are experiencing every single day, risking their lives, possibly bringing the sickness home to their families. They truly are the everyday heroes in our country, and they needed to be treated as such. Operator, will you open a line up for questions, please?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. One moment while we queue. And our first question comes from Sam Brody with The Daily Beast. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for doing the call. President Saunders mentioned this at the top of the call, but I wanted to raise it again if you or Senator Brown would like to respond. But Obviously, Senate Republicans are pushing for limits on employer liability as folks return to work. Just so I'm clear, can I get your response to that proposal, and is there any version of that proposal that Democrats might consider in the context of a broader CARES 2.0?
Well, I'll let Senator Brown answer part of that question, and then I'll speak my mind after he answers the question. Senator Brown.
Sure. Keep in mind how this started. The first coronavirus, the first major coronavirus package that became the CARES Act, started off with Senator McConnell doing what he does. It was a bailout for the airlines, a lot of help to Wall Street and a lot of big corporations, nothing for local governments, nothing for hospitals, nothing for unemployment insurance for laid off workers. So every step of this has been a fight to get Senate Republicans and President Trump to do anything on state and local government, let alone pandemic pay, let alone protection for workers. So it started off with that. Then we forced him to the table and he negotiated, and so he could get the things he wanted. We were able to get that money for state and local government. It's not enough. We were able to get the unemployment benefits. They don't last long enough. It's only through the end of July. So we go back and fight for these. McConnell, first, he said, you know, then he says he wants them to declare bankruptcy, and then he kind of backed off that and said he wants these liability provisions to help his corporate buddies. But the answer is no. We're not going to negotiate from a position of saying, oh, we'll take a few crumbs, we'll take a few dollars for local communities, but in return, you're going to have to give up all kinds of legal protections for workers. That's been the McConnell way. Always put it on the backs of workers, but we're simply not going to bite. We're going to continue to put the pressure on. We're going to continue to organize local officials in both parties, plenty of Republican mayors, plenty of Republican county commissioners in places like Marion and Morrow County, near where Officer Miller lives. Plenty of those officials are Republicans and want to see us succeed in this just as much as I do.
And I would just add, and I agree with everything that Senator Brown said, but there should be no negotiations, no trade-offs when you're dealing with people's lives and you're dealing with their families' lives, because they are providing the essential services every single day. State and local governments must receive aid from the federal government. They have to, in order to keep public services running, to protect our workers, and to protect our communities across the country. To do anything less is irresponsible, and we will not accept it at all.
And our next question comes from Andrew Welsh Huggins with Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Andrew Welsh Huggins. Thanks for doing this call. This is for the Ohio Corrections Officers. As you know, there's been calls for a huge number of inmates to be released to help relieve pressure on the prisons. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about that proposal and also whether you think it would do any good at this point.
Speaking from Marion's standpoint, I don't see where it would, because what you'll be doing is there's so much of our population that's infected right now that you're going to pretty much just be releasing the infected back out into the public. Right now, I see us as a point of no return, to where we've got to ride this thing out.
So short of that. Some way to limit these long double shifts you're working. I mean, what are your top priorities for the state to do to help you all?
They started to. Oh, go ahead, Michael.
This is Michael Ryder from Columbus, Ohio. I'm not sure. PPE is the biggest thing, because if we have the proper PPE, you're going to help protect people from actually contracting this virus. And that's the biggest problem now, is you got so many workers that are out, not able to work because they've contracted this virus. So providing us with the right PPE would help put us in a better direction across the board.
Can I speak on that as well from Connecticut?
Sure.
It's the same idea as Mike said. I mean, we did not have the proper equipment when this all came down. They waited way too long. So as he stated, all of our guys were dropping sick. They had to leave. They had to go out. That's what caused the real understaffing at our place. We are understaffed, don't get me wrong, but this wiped us out. And that was the problem. The PPE was not there. It was not there. And, again, they're 3 weeks too late, 4 weeks too late on getting it to us. And that has caused the problem here in Connecticut.
Right. And, see, here in Columbus, Ohio, we got a double-edged sword. Because not only does our staff go down, we also are the main medical hub for the state. So we also staff a prison unit at OSU Wexner Medical Center Hospital that we also have to staff. So as these inmates that are coming in from all these surrounding prisons, sick and our rooms are going up, it's not only is our staff going down, but as these rooms go up, we're getting hit from both sides. We can't keep up with the demand of number of inmates getting sick, and at the same time, our officers are going down. So it's kind of a double-edged sword for us.
So your rooms are filling up both at Franklin Medical and at the Wexner centers that you staff?
Yeah, I mean, we probably would average about 15 satellite rooms or inmates in rooms within the hospital. As of last week, we had 106. Our biggest shift houses about 108 to 110 officers. So that's one shift, you know, just at the hospital. I mean, we don't have nowhere near that manpower. So, I mean, that's where we stand.
Thank you.
Question comes from Zach Cohen with National Journal. Please go ahead.
Hi. Quick question. Thanks for doing this call. A quick question for Senator Brown. Senator, do you plan to come back to Washington next week when the Senate reconvenes? And if so, how do you plan to make the trip?
I'm sorry, I have my mute on. I'm sorry about that. I do, yes, and I plan to come by car. I think that Mitch McConnell, I think that he's wrong to bring us back into session. When I look at the number of
people. I'm sorry, Senator, it's very hard to hear you. Can you speak up?
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll start again.
Okay, so is that better?
Much, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I plan to come back to Washington. I will come in a car. I'm not taking an airplane. I haven't been in a plane in a month, or well, in 6 weeks, six, 7 weeks. I think that Senator McConnell, he's done nothing to prepare for the safety of the police officers that have to come to work, and the security, and the custodian crew, and the cleaning crew, and they've got to come by public transportation in many cases, on buses and subways, when the mayor of Washington and the governors of Maryland and Virginia have had stay-at-home orders. Senator McConnell seems more interested in political show and in confirming federal judges, than young right-wing federal judges, than he does in protecting mm-hmm. public health. We could do all these things from remote and then all come together and vote for the bill, but Senator McConnell thinks it's okay to expose all these workers, including us and our staffs. And I'm asking almost no staff to come in. I think that, but unfortunately, all this other people that work in the Senate, the police officers, the food service people, the cleaning crews have to come, and I think that's wrong.
Our next question comes from Jack Lynch with HANA News Service. Please go ahead.
Hi, Senator Brown. This is Jack Lynch from HANA News Service in Columbus. It seems like there is a possibility that funding for state and local governments might it either might not happen or it might be inadequate. What happens if the funding doesn't come?
Well, it's up to me to fight for the funding. And if the funding doesn't come, we will see safety forces laid off in communities. We'll see counties not able to provide to get services on children's services. I did a conference call with people that take care of abused children and foster children and through our county agencies. And some of them are already considering layoffs. Mitch McConnell, as Lee Saunders said, Mitch McConnell, the leader, the Republican leader of the Senate, didn't care about the budget deficit when he gave a tax break where 80% of the benefits went to the richest people in the country, $1.5 trillion tax break. He doesn't care about the deficit when he bails out corporate interests and takes care of his tobacco company friends and his oil company friends and his drug company friends. But now all of a sudden he thinks about a budget deficit when it comes to workers and communities and in cities and counties in our country. And I just think eventually enough people will put pressure on him that he does the right thing.
And let me just add to that. We're experiencing layoffs and furloughs all over the country right now because of the tax base crumbling right before our eyes for state and local governments. But you heard the stories that these correction officers talked about today, two from Ohio, one from Connecticut. We can talk about these stories in every single state across the country with corrections officers or sanitation workers, healthcare workers, all of those classifications that are providing essential services every single day and really risking their lives. And they're going to work because they're committed and they're everyday heroes. And I don't think that the American public would accept for all the things that they are doing for us. I don't think the American public would accept them getting pink slips. And we can't let that happen. And that's why we've got to put as much pressure on our elected officials as possible to get this done. We have to get this done to continue essential public services in state and local governments across the country.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Danielle Marone with Bloomberg News. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Danielle Moran. Senator Brown, you said that robust funding is needed to go to state and local government. Do you have a number in mind, and what is that?
I'm not going to offer a number because there will be negotiations and with Senator Schumer and McConnell and Pelosi, or at least with Senator Schumer and Pelosi in the White House. And I don't want to overstate or understate a number. I do know that the $150 billion was a significant start. It started at zero with McConnell. We then got it to $150 billion. We know we need a lot more than that. And every day it gets harder the longer that McConnell waits to say yes on funding for local governments and state governments. The more acute the problem is, the more layoffs they'll have, the more cuts in services. I don't think we've seen anything yet compared to what we're going to see if Congress doesn't move on this quickly.
Thank you.
Sure.
And our next question comes from Sheena Elise with Spectrum News. Please go ahead.
Hi. I have a question for the people working out of Ohio, the corrections officers there. Can you all describe what it's like inside the jail and what's being done without the proper PPE? What do you guys do when so many are sick?
Oh, thanks, honey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh. Oh, okay.
I mean,
Yeah, it's like utter chaos. I mean, I really don't know how to describe it to you. It's one of these things that you'd almost have to see to kind of experience. I mean, we got folks that are scared. I mean, we got folks that don't want to be here. And you got inmates that are the same way. They don't want to be here. They're scared. It's just utter chaos, you know. And when it comes to the PPE, yeah, we're given, like I said, surgical masks. You know, we recently started being given that. Working out of OSU, which is a hospital here in Ohio, same thing. You know, your nurses up there are complaining about the same thing, the lack of equipment. If you had the equipment to begin with, I don't think that your number of infections would be nowhere near as high as they are. You know, I think that's probably across the country.
And speaking of the number of infections, you all have mentioned 90% inmates sick and half the staff. In terms of numbers, how many people are we talking about?
That was mostly for Marion. We're probably talking around 2,000.
2,000 inmates, or all together?
2,000, around 2,000 all together.
I'm sorry, what was that?
It'd be about 2,000 all together. Just like Mike was talking about, you know, he is a medical facility. Marion is not a medical facility. And the atmosphere is where people are scared. Remy, the staff, they're all scared. And the officers are going to work doing the job every day anyway, knowing that there's a case. But we just have bodies everywhere. We're placing people in places where we don't normally house inmates at. It's crazy. And your opinion seems like full of chaos.
I'm sorry. I'm hearing it echo. I don't know if somebody.
I heard the same thing. So basically, at Marion, you've got roughly 2,000 of their 2,500 inmates sick. And you've gotten over 100 of their staff that's been sick and infected by it. That's roughly the numbers. Those numbers are public information. You can go on ODRC website, and they actually have a list that they update daily for anybody that wants to view it.
Okay. I mean, I think he touched on it a little bit, but I couldn't really hear it. But it sounded like
yes.
He was talking about, the inmates and what happens when somebody gets sick. I mean, are they still living in close quarters, or, I mean, how close, what are the living quarters like? How close do the officers have to get to them? What is that like?
Our job entails being hands-on. I mean, that's just as close as you can get. I mean, we have to be hands-on. They quarantine them, they isolate them, and at that point, there's different measures taken in place, but in the meantime, you know, our job entails times. There's times we have to be hands-on. So there's no way to avoid us not having contact with them.
Right, and at Marion, we're an open dorm setting. Some of our housing units are just an open dorm, and some of them are cell block. So there is no real way to quarantine them. From staff or anything, the staff are in the dormitories with them.
Hey Lee, I got to get off. I'm doing a conference call with a bunch of senators on the package what we're doing. So I got to get off. But,
thank you very much.
Ohio. I really, really appreciate it. And the gentleman in Connecticut, too, thanks for the three of you, for your union activism and for your public service. Thanks, Lee. Thanks, Lee.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And it appears that we have no further questions at this time. And I would like to turn the program back to AFSCME President Saunders Lee for any closing remarks.
Well, I just want to thank Brian and Michael and Steve once again for being the everyday heroes. And I would just ask those of you who have listened to their stories to publicize it and talk about it and associate with the experiences that they dealt with today. I just can't imagine being in the situation, and they have to live it every single day without the proper support and the proper help and the proper equipment, and they're still doing their job or trying to do their job the best that they can. That just shows to me that we need state and local aid to support them, to help them provide essential public services in Ohio and Connecticut and across the country. And again, as I said earlier, we're going to continue to push this. This is our number one priority. We've got to protect and fund the front line. So thanks, everybody, for being on the call today.